The really striking thing about the partnership of Lee and J.J. Schubert as it comes to the end of the 1930s is the steady decline in the dynamism of the partnership. At first glance, Lee and J.J. appear to retain all their old genius. The lawsuits and the disputes, the financial hocus-pocus, the wriggling out of their obligations and into other people's, all this went on as before, but the creative output was falling. By 1937, the year of Between the Devil, there were only 7 productions with the Schubert Jolly Roger flying from the masthead. By 1939, there were only 4, by 1940, only 3, and by 1941, only 1. There must have been a great many reasons for this, financial, personal, psychological, even historical. But the main factor seems to have been that Lee and J.J., having failed in their attempt to come to a percentage deal with the great producer in the sky, were simply getting older. And their vitality and venom were beginning to be diluted by old age. Why, as the 1940s began, it was all that Lee and J.J. could do to muster the energy to detest each other. They managed it, though, and still had a bit of spite left over for the outside world, which they continued to bombard with music. Some of it indifferent, but some of it really quite memorable. For instance, there was this very attractive item by Hoagy Carmichael.
Heart and soul, I fell in love with you. Heart and soul, the way a fool would do. Madly, because you held me tight and stole a kiss in the night. Heart and soul, I begged to be adored. Lost control and tumbled overboard. Gladly, that magic night we kissed there in the moon mist. Oh, but your lips were thrilling, much too thrilling. Never before were mine so strangely willing. But now I see what one embrace can do. Look at me, it got me loving you madly. That little kiss you stole held all my heart and soul.
In the winter of 1939-40, the Schubert brothers produced a show called Keep Off the Grass, and Larry Adler, with his gift for tangling with people one should never tangle with, found himself in the cast.
It had in it Jimmy Durant, Ray Bolger, Jackie Gleason, tremendous talent, and yet with all that, it really wasn't a good show. Jimmy McHugh and Dorothy Fields did the score. You couldn't get better at the time, and still it wasn't a good show. And the Schuberts themselves, I didn't like working for. They were not nice people.
Indeed, there were even some folk around who doubted if they were people at all. But before we proceed with Larry Adler's story of Keep Off the Grass, it might be useful to retrace our steps to earlier in 1939 and find out how the Schuberts stumbled on yet another of their big stars. In 1938, Lee had taken a long trip to South America. Whether or not to take an option on Argentina, nobody knows, but in the course of his travels, he came across a girl in Rio and signed her immediately. In the summer of 1939, the girl starred in a review called Streets of Paris, or More Streets of Paris, or Son of Streets of Paris, or something. The details are irrelevant as well as grisly, but the cast was scintillating. Abbott and Costello, Gower Champion, and several others. But the big hit was Lee Schubert's surprise package from Rio. She swiveled her hips like a contortionist, she looked from the back row of the stalls like a useful bantamweight contender, and she sounded like this.
Ai, 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 é o canto do pregoneiro que com sua harmonia traz alegria em South America. Ai, 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 e o que traz no seu tabuleiro vem de praia, yo, vem de praia, ia, em salsa, mel e canoê. E vem de vatapa, e vem de caruru, e vem de mungonzai, vem de umbu. Se o tabuleiro tem e tudo que convém, mas só lhe falta, ia, belenguendez. Ai, 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 é o canto do pregoneiro que com sua harmonia traz alegria em salsa, mel e canoê. Ai, ai, ai.
Ai, 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 ai,
em South America.
Carmen Miranda, starring in Streets and More Streets of Paris, was fine. The box office ticked over with a kind of regularity which brought a glow of pride to the Schuberts and their relatives, all of whom worked somewhere in the organization. But the show that Larry Adler was talking about, Keep Off the Grass, wasn't doing so good.
I had a number called On the Old Park Bench, which I did with three other comedians, and we were all dressed as tramps. Now, after the Old Park Bench number in the first act, I did my solo in the second act. Schubert decided that he wanted the Old Park Bench number repeated. And I didn't want to do that tramp number after my solo, because I did my solo in White Tie and Tails, and I felt, maybe because of the way I'd been treated all along, I didn't want to get back into tramp makeup for that Old Park Bench number. So I said I wasn't going to do it. So Schubert sent for me. He said, "What do you mean you're not going to do it?" And I told him. He said, "Oh, big man, eh?" And I got very angry, and I said, "Yes, big man." He said, "Okay, big man, you better do good tonight or you're out of the show." Well, this infuriated me. Now, up until then, my solo number had been going all right, but no more than all right. After this conversation with Schubert, I was angry, furiously angry, and I went out on stage, and for the first time, my number stopped the show cold. So he didn't fire me, and from then on, it stopped the show every night. And I didn't have to do the Old Park Bench number either. But I would love some psychiatrist to analyze and tell me not only why, all right, I can see the adrenaline working to make me work better that one night after the quarrel with Schubert, but why did it work well from then on? I've never been able to understand that. It always stopped the show from then on, and it never had before.
Larry Adler's testimony substantiates an impression that keeps growing the more one studies the Schubert saga, and that is that their shows were put on in a haphazard, sometimes downright amateur way, often with the most disastrous results. In a sense, they were actually unprofessional, these arch-professional showmen, and part of the trouble was they couldn't bear to let any money go out of the family. It was bad enough having to give your relatives money, but giving it to imperfect strangers, well, that was not to be thought of at all. And so the Schubert Empire became a bewildering, ramshackle edifice of crazy nepotism with cousins and in-laws and nephews all jostling for sinecures and access to the honeypot, sometimes with really the most amazing results. The most famous liability of all was probably the nephew Lawrence Schubert, who was commissioned by his uncles to design and build a new theatre in Philadelphia. It proved to be a theatre that everyone could be proud of, except the actors and the actresses, because young Lawrence had forgotten to put in any dressing rooms. Lee Schubert remarked gloomily, "I got a brother, he's an idiot, but not intentionally. But my nephew, Lawrence, he's an idiot intentionally." Now, Lawrence got his own back by waiting till his uncle Jake, the one who was an idiot not intentionally, went on an ocean voyage. Lawrence sent him a wire reading, "Dear Uncle Jake, don't worry if the ship sinks, you don't own it, love, Lawrence." And how would Jake react to this sort of thing? Well, he had a very funny habit of reacting to a crisis by doing one of two things. Let creditors gather, let governments grumble, let tax officials snoop and audiences stay away, Jake had one antidote. He would find a theatre, hire a band, and fill the place with one of two things. Either this...
Under your window, deep in my shadow, stand I here alone. My song, the night wind weaves a pleading like my own.
Or this.
Overhead the moon is beaming, white as blossoms on the bough. nothing is had but the song of a bird, filling all the air with a dreaming. Could my heart be still it beating? Only you can tell it all, beloved. From your window give me greeting.
Jake Schubert revived Blossom Time and the Student Prince so many times that a shrewd actor could actually make a profession out of knowing the two scores. But as the number of original Schubert productions fell, so Lee Schubert's knack of bestowing charity continued to flourish. One of Lee's problems was to know what to do with the regiments of chorus girls who had passed through what you might euphemistically call his office. Larry Adler is not so euphemistic.
The Schubert casting couch was very famous. I mean, if a girl was auditioning for a part, that was it. And they also had a manager who was called Ma Simmons. He was very camp and very queer. And in order to get a good part in a Schubert show, it was better if you were very camp and queer as well. And as I was neither, I didn't get a very good part in the Schubert show. And as I wasn't a pretty girl, I didn't get to the Schubert casting couch either. So I had it bad both ways.
People used to speculate sometimes on how Lee Schubert used to put his old lady friends out to grass. The most interesting theory was put forward by a St. Louis theatre critic who went one night and heard this.
Under your window, deep in my shadow, stand I here alone.
Or maybe this.
Overhead the moon is beaming, white as blossoms on the bough. Nothing is heard but the song of a bird, filling all the air with a dreaming.
Whichever of the two he did hear, the St. Louis theatre critic took in one earful of the awful rending sounds coming from the stage and wrote, "We admire Mr. Schubert's loyalty, but we do wish he would pension his overage chorus girls to some other cause than the St. Louis Municipal Light Opera Company." A welcome bit of musical contrast was provided around this time by the fact that an ancient song from a forgotten Schubert show suddenly became the biggest hit in America. The Schuberts had originally presented it back in 1931, when it hadn't done all that well. But now, what with the war intensifying feelings of love and sentiment, the omens were much more auspicious for this type of song. I wonder what Lee and J.J. thought as they sat and watched one of the most famous sequences in movie history. Probably they were wondering how to get a piece of the action, but this is the song they had first introduced to the world.
You must remember this. Is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers move, they still say, "I love you." On that you can rely, no matter what the future brings, as time goes by. Jealousy and hate. Woman needs man, and man must have his mate, that no one can deny. It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory.
While As Time Goes By was knocking them dead in Casablanca, the movie, not the place, the Schuberts continued to stumble rather than march towards coherent productions. After all, how does a smart Broadway review come by its most effective wisecracks? Bob Hope has one hair-raising account.
We were playing in Philadelphia, and Fanny Brice had had some trouble with her teeth, and she took too many pills. And the most dramatic thing I ever saw in a theater was when she stood out and won and repeated her number. She was out of it. And they had to finally close in the big fire curtain in front of her to get her off the stage nicely because she was gone. She had taken too much of this stuff. We were personal friends, and we used to go and eat with her at her apartment about once a week. And we had a ball with her. Freddie DiCordova, who's a stage director, used to run around and get us all working. I did this number with Eve Arden where I'd sing Can't Get Started with her, and she'd kind of walk away. Then I'd approach her from the back and sing over her shoulder to her. And then one time I was panting. I went, telling her how much I loved her. And I walked in the stage door one night, and the doorman said, "You know, when you pant like that, you ought to have Eve Arden just turn to you and say, 'Have you been running?'" Now, this is the doorman. And we put that line in the show that night. It was one of the biggest laughs you ever saw.
I've flown around the world in a plane. I've settled revolutions in Spain. And the North Pole I have charted. Still I can get started with you. On the golf course, I'm under par. Metro-Goldwyn have asked me to star. I've got a house, a show place. Still I can't get no place with you. 'Cause you're so supreme. Lyrics I write of you, I dream, dream day and night of you, and I scheme just for the sight of you. Baby, what good does it do? I've been consulted by Franklin D. Greta Garbo has had me to tea. Still I'm broken hearted, 'cause I can't get started with you.
The machinations of the Schuberts through the 1930s and 40s are so involved, legally speaking, that it would take a crooked lawyer to follow them all. At one point, Lee did something with his attorneys, and Jake found himself virtually dispossessed. Going into a huddle with his own legal advisors, Jake thought about it and eventually came up with a countermove.
Under your window, deep in the shadow, stand I here alone.
But if the schmaltzy melodies of the mythical Vienna were Jake's consolation, his brother Lee was a little more imaginative, or perhaps a little more desperate. From time to time, he would produce something that posterity can thank him for, although it was usually for the wrong reasons. In 1938, for instance, he became involved with, of all people, Cole Porter, who wrote a show for him called You Never Know. Clifton Webb was the star, and by his usual methods, Lee managed to make a mess of it. The show closed in haste, leaving the Schuberts to repent at leisure. But there was one item in the show that really was quite outstanding. Like many songs of its class, trapped inside a turkey production, nothing was heard of it for a while until eventually it was rescued by a perceptive artist. Now, this was the song that audiences didn't seem to be impressed by when Lee Schubert gave it to them first in 1938.
Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it Granada I see, or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long last love? Is it an earthquake or simply a shock? Is it the good turtle soup or is it merely the mock? Is it a cocktail, this feeling of joy? Or is what I feel the real McCoy? Is it for all time or simply a lark? Is it Granada I see, or only Asbury Park? Is it a fancy not worth thinking of? Or is it at long, long, long last love?
At Long Last Love is not quite the title to describe the relations between the Schubert relations. Lee and Jake hadn't talked to each other for years, and indeed Jake was becoming so misanthropic that he wouldn't even talk to himself. Certainly, he refused to talk to his son John, who by now was in the family business. At one point, young John Schubert, summoning up all the reserves of family affection, said of his father, "If he'd have had an education, he could have been Hitler." When the Second World War embraced the United States, Lee, who was 69 years old, did the usual Schubert trick of lying about his age and enlisted for the draft. The smart Alex said that if only he'd joined the Japanese army, the United States would have won in 3 months. But the funny thing was that physically, Lee was supposed to look a bit like that. One associate described him as like a Japanese admiral of Jewish descent. Jake was much less impressed by the war with Japan. As his official biographer wrote, he'd been fighting with everyone for so long that Pearl Harbor was just December the 7th to him. In any case, Jake had other things on his mind, musical things. After spending most of 1942 reviving Gilbert and Sullivan, he astonished his friends by beginning 1943 with this.
Overhead the moon is beaming, white as blossoms on the bough.
By 1946, not for the first time, the Schubert Empire, for years now propped up by financial wheeler dealing that had less than nothing to do with show business, came under fire from the antitrust laws. It transpired that the brothers owned 17 New York theaters, and it seemed often as though 15 of them were featuring this.
Under your window, deep in my shadow, stand I here.
In 1951, Lee Schubert, aged 74 or 72 or 71, died, leaving the kind of will that only attorneys ever profit by. And at this time, another song originally launched with Schubert money suddenly had a new lease of life. Remember the 1938 show Between the Devil? The one that Evelyn Leigh got paid for without a contract? Well, in that show, there was one of the great comic songs of the decade. And in 1951, at MGM Studios, one of the original cast members of Between the Devil, Jack Buchanan, was making his last movie in the good company of Fred Astaire. One of the songs they sang was the joke piece from Between the Devil, whose lyric, by Howard Dietz, might almost have been written with Lee, Sam, and J.J. in mind. It was called Triplets.
We do everything alike. We look alike, we dress alike, we walk alike, we talk alike, and what is more, we hate each other very much. We hate our folks, we're sick of jokes on what an art it is to tell us apart. If one of us gets the measles,
another one gets the measles,
then all of us gets the measles, and mumps, and croup. How I wish I had a gun, a widow gun. It would be fun to shoot the other two and be only one.
Mrs. Whiffle-Poofer loves to talk to Mrs. Hildendorfer of the fatal natal day she had her silly Willy.
Mrs. Hassan-Cooper Gopher loves to talk to Mrs. Goldenwasser of her major operation when she had her twins.
But when Mother comes along, she silences the others. She accomplished something that is very rare in mothers.
MGM has got a Leo, but Mama has got a trio. She is proud but says three is a crowd.
Oh, we do everything alike. We look alike. We dress alike, we walk alike, we talk alike. And what is more, we hate each other very much. We hate our folks. We're sick of jokes on what an art it is to tell us apart. We eat the same kind of victuals. We drink the same kind of bottles. We sit in the same kind of high chair.
High chair, high chair.
I had a gun, a little gun. It would be fun to shoot the other two and be only one.
After Lee's death, J.J. found that life wasn't the same anymore. Fighting with strangers simply wasn't the same thing. People noticed that Jake was becoming morose and was often seen wandering down the long aisles of his own vast costume library, daydreaming among the crinolines and stale Wiener schnitzels of old Vienna, thinking tenderly of the chorus girls and the lawsuits, the great libel actions and the wonderful nights. Also, he was dreaming about what Lee's will was supposed to mean. How much money did the Schuberts actually have? How much of it was Jake's? Who owned what and who had given what to whom? And how? 14 years after Lee's death, the will was still being contested. But by then, Jake was too dead to care anymore. He expired in 1963, aged 85 or 86 or 84, give or take a year or two, leaving the United States to battle on in its struggle to get hold of $15 million of back taxes. The complexities of the estate were terrifying. An astute lawyer might make a lifetime's occupation out of them. In fact, so hopeless a mess did the Schubert saga finally slide into that the only sensible way of summing up the family is to return to its origins and remind ourselves how the three brothers... Yes, there were three at first. Remember Sam, who died in 1905 and missed so much of the fun? How they started out. Gerald Schoenfeld, who has done considerable work at the Schubert Agency, trying to keep the ship on a more even keel since the old piratical days, sums up.
The Schubert business traces its origins back to the turn of the century, when Sam Schubert ventured from Syracuse to New York City and acquired the first Schubert Theater in Herald Square, New York. Sam Schubert was joined by his brother Lee Schubert, and the two together expanded their theater holdings and also engaged in the business of producing shows. Sam Schubert met an untimely death in 1905, and at that time the youngest brother, J.J. Schubert, joined his brother Lee Schubert in New York, and the two together continued the work originally started by Sam Schubert and developed the Schubert business to a preeminent position in the American theater. And by the time of the year 1927, they had acquired by lease or by ownership 110 theaters throughout the United States, were responsible for the booking of hundreds of other theaters throughout the United States, and were also the most prolific theatrical producers. The record of the Schubert brothers still exists today, having produced approximately 520 shows, a record that has not been equaled by any other producing organization.
The precise score is exactly 520, including dozens of this.
Under your window, deep in my shadow, stand I here alone.
And scores of this.
Overhead the moon is beaming, white as blossoms on the bough.
Before we return to the summing up of Gerald Schoenfeld, a word from the veteran songwriter Irving Caesar, who worked for the Schuberts in the 1920s, and remembers that even for a showbiz tycoon, J.J. Schubert wasn't exactly anyone's idea of an egghead. Perhaps it was that preoccupation with the student prince that addled J.J.'s vocabulary. Enter Irving Caesar on the Schuberts.
They were just businessmen who owned theaters and hard-fisted. Of course, J.J. fancied himself as a producer, as a man full of drama, as a director, but he was none of those. And Lee, of course, was just a crass businessman. I have an interesting story with J.J. Schubert. We're at the Winter Garden. And the leading lady, or whoever she was a clothes horse, a tall girl with a voice of sorts, and she was singing a song that Harold Atteridge had written the lyrics for, and I think Romberg the music for, I'm not sure. A song called Omar Khayyam, da-da-da, Omar Khayyam was fond of women, wine, and song. This was during the dress rehearsal, and I'm sitting there with Jake, and he says, come here, young lady. You should know that this is Omar Af Khayyam and not Omar Khayyam. Well, she couldn't stand there and argue with him. Take the number over again. He was showing his authority and his knowledge. So she went back in the orchestra, and she came out and began singing it again. But by that time, Harold Atteridge, the lyric writer, who had been in the sixth row, the librettist, he also wrote the book, had time to go to Jake and whisper in his ear, J.J., you're wrong. It is Omar Khayyam. It isn't Omar Af Khayyam. And as the lady came out again, the girl singing Omar Af Khayyam, he says, take the Af out. The show is too long anyhow.
Compared to that, Gerald Schoenfeld's narrative might sound a bit sober, but sobriety is what we need in this welter of faux pas and chaos that comprises the Schubert story. So, proceed, Mr. Schoenfeld.
With the advent of the Depression of the 1930s, the Schubert business underwent a radical change and was reduced to a much lesser number of theaters, I think somewhere approximating 60. As the Depression years wore on, the Schubert fortunes continued to be adversely affected, and with the emergence of World War II, had reached a low point.
Not quite. June 8th, 1943, Broadway sees a new Schubert opening.
Overhead the moon is beaming, white as blossoms on the bough. Nothing is heard but the song of a bird, filling all the air with a dreaming. Could my heart be still its beating? Only you can tell it all.
It was a smash. Again. Oh, well, back to Mr. Schoenfeld.
The theater acquisitions of the Schuberts did not increase. Their production activities continued to decrease. This is probably true, of course, as they were then getting much older.
Not only were the Schuberts getting older, but so were their shows, even the new ones. September 4th, 1943, another Schubert smash hit opens on Broadway.
Under your window, deep in my shadow, stand I here alone.
They continued to be major investors in productions. In about the year 1948, their activities came under the scrutiny of the Department of Justice. And in 1950, the Department of Justice brought an action against the Schubert business, claiming that it was in violation of the antitrust laws. After 6 years of protracted litigation, the action was settled with the government, and certain of the terms of the settlement required the Schubert brothers to divest themselves of their ownership in certain theaters throughout the United States. It was really Jacob J. Schubert who was left to carry out the provisions of the agreement with the government. So commencing in 1956, the business underwent another change in that it was thereafter subject to regulation, or if you would, overseeing by the Department of Justice. And to this day, as with any company that operates under a decree, the provisions have to be adhered to.
Mr. Schoenfeld explains how radically altered the Schubert policy has become now that the Schuberts themselves are not there to obstruct the course of true art.
Today, the theater business is substantially different. However, in many respects, it's carried on in the same way. We today are trying to devote ourselves to areas which would be stimulative of a return by the public to the habit of theater going. We're interested in the development of new audiences. We're interested in new ways of merchandising and selling tickets. We're interested in presenting plays which would have a variety of appeal to a variety of theatergoers, such as the young and the racially mixed as well as the traditional theater goer who happened to come from the upper middle class or middle class with a particular intelligence level.
A particular intelligence level, oh my, Omar of Khayyam. But at the end of it all, what do we have? A trio of brothers who couldn't even decide how old they were. A trio which became a pair after a train smash in 1905. Why were they so avaricious? The answer is the same old one of poverty. Once the wolf has sniffed at the door, the smell of the wolf remains in their nostrils forever.
They were desperately poor people. A story goes that one of their sisters died of malnutrition in Syracuse. J.J. Schubert used to sell newspapers on the street corners. His mother used to have to put him on the corner because he was too frightened of the dark. Sam Schubert sold cigars in the trains before the age of 10. And at the age of 10, he was the treasurer of the Syracuse Theater. They had to take their shoes off in their house so they wouldn't wear out the shoe leather. And they overcame this desperate poverty, and there's a Horatio Alger story in the great American tradition.
By a stroke of irony, one of the Schubert productions of the Depression years contained a song that perhaps more than any other symbolized the kind of want that Gerald Schoenfeld is talking about. Although by the time the song came out in 1932, the Schuberts were down to their last $20 million.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower up to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Why don't you remember? I'm your pal. Say, buddy, can you spare a dime? Once in khaki suits, ah, gee, we look swell, full of that Yankee doodly-dum. Half a million boots went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum. Oh, say, don't you remember? They called me Al. It was Al all the time. Say, don't you remember? I'm your pal. Buddy, can you spare a dime?
Lee and J.J. Schubert, an enigmatic pair and yet laughably transparent. Schoenfeld differentiates between them.
Lee Schubert was the more public of the two Schubert brothers, and J.J. Schubert was the more private of the Schubert brothers. The two brothers themselves were not close with each other in their social life, although no decision, I believe, was ever made by either one without the consultation and acquiescence of the other. They had a unique partnership which, despite their personal involvements with each other, was such that either brother could withdraw from the partnership. Whatever he needed for his personal mode of life or living, and the other could do likewise. At the end of the year, if one had drawn more than the other, it made no difference. They struck a balance. Neither one paid back the other, and they started off afresh. There was enough for both. They evoked a tremendous loyalty from the people who worked for them, even though they always would say that their business was a 7-day-a-week, 24-hour-day business.
Tremendous loyalty, Enter Larry Adler.
I remember this, that after the second or third week, Schubert's announced that the entire cast would take a 25% salary cut. They didn't ask him, they just told him. And I told you before that I didn't like the Schuberts or the way they worked, so I said I wasn't going to take a cut. And by God, Ma Simmons came to my dressing room and said, look, we don't want to break up the show, so you keep your salary and we won't tell the rest. And I said, God damn it, no. If they're taking a cut, they must know that I'm not taking a cut. He says, well, if you don't take a cut and they know it, they won't take a cut either, and the show's liable to close. And I absolutely refused. This might have been very stubborn of me, but then, of course, when the rest of the cast heard I wasn't taking a cut, then neither did they. And, in fact, the show did close. And I've had guilt feelings about that ever since. But at the same time, I just didn't feel they were within their rights to announce a blanket 25% cut like that, because we weren't making all that much anyway.
Tremendous loyalty, all right, with the whole cast getting the push together, the true democratic spirit. Now, what else does Mr. Schoenfeld think that the Schubert boys had in the way of Boy Scout virtues?
J.J. Schubert, for most of the time, would be traveling, working abroad, working on shows, and the attention to the New York base would be taken care of by Mr. Lee Schubert.
J.J. had to travel abroad in order to find out how to stage
under
and
overhead.
Admittedly, J.J. was pretty busy a lot of the time, and Irving Caesar tells us why and how.
I was sitting with J.J. or Rowan Backham at one of the rehearsals. This was Nina Rosa, and we had many tall girls in there, maybe 24 across the stage. And he had them all lined up. And Jake held his head between his hands and went from left to right with his head. And I thought he was suffering a headache. And I rushed over to him and with simulated solicitude, because I didn't care if he had a headache or not, to tell the truth, I said, J.J., you know, I was very, very young, and after all, he was my boss. What's the matter? Is anything wrong? He says, no, Irving, my boy. He says, look at that line. So I looked. He says, every one of them, Irving, every one of them. I says, what do you mean? He says, how long have you been rehearsal? I said, about 4 weeks. He says, every one of them, Irving. I didn't miss a one. And you know what he meant. And it was the truth.
Adored one, I am yours, what more can I say? But tell you again that come what may, I'll part from you never. Adored one, there's nothing that I wouldn't do to know that I could hold. Forever.
happy days with the student prince and blossom time and half the chorus girls in America. Schoenfeld recalls that the relationship of the Schuberts with Justice was never very tight and often relaxed to the point where the two lost contact altogether.
They had a litigation pending for many, many, many years in England. And at the termination of the litigation, Lee Schubert received a telegram that Justice has triumphed. And he immediately dispatched a wire, appeal at once.
So there we are. Lee, J.J., and Sam Schubert, the three adventurers of the American theater. Three men who were soon reduced to two and who acquired enough power for 200. Two modern cookies who, the moment trouble beckoned, scampered back into the haven of the old Habsburg schmaltzy operetta. Men who gave charity with the air of a prison guard doling out iron rations. Men who left behind them innumerable testimonials which prove the warmness of their hearts.
They're awful people to deal with.
They proceeded along a certain line of acrimony.
They had a kind of disregard for people. They didn't care about people's feelings or their self-respect or anything else.
I had experience with the Schuberts. Oh, terrible experience with the Schuberts. Terrible experience.
I didn't like them.
You just certainly didn't get anything out of them at all.
They were always cutting corners, cutting expenses.
All they were interested in were profits.
The Schuberts put on junk shows.
Our relationship was never happy.
The joke about the Schuberts was they'd use the scenery from the last show for the new show. They just changed the titles.
They were really considered the bottom of the heap. I mean, everything was such poor quality. The costumes, the scenery.
The Schubert casting couch was very famous. I mean, if a girl was auditioning for a part, that was it.
J.J. had nothing for the theater. He was strictly a money man.
They were very, very tough.
I didn't like them.
He never paid very well. The salary was always the very lowest that was paid at the time.
They ran their theaters like a dime store.
Sigmund Rundberg, he was the tool of the Schuberts. I mean, they really exploited him and they were dreadful to him. They had him by the scruff of the neck.
Lee came out and he said, "We will get that son of a bitch."
Our relationship was never happy.
Everything was very tawdry. I mean, it was just not the thing to do. It lowered your whole standard to a bit in a Schubert show.
The Schubert casting couch was very famous. I didn't like them.
Awful people.
Terrible experience.
I didn't like them.
Always cutting corners.
Profits.
Junk shows.
Never happy.
Bottom of the heap.
That was it.
Strictly a money man.
Very, very tough.
Never paid very well.
Son of a bitch.
Very tawdry.
I didn't like them.
Awful people.
Terrible.
I didn't like them.
Always cutting corners.
Profits.
Junk shows.
Never happy.
Bottom of the heap.
That was it. Strictly a money man.
Very, very tough.
Never paid very well.
Son of a bitch.
Very tawdry.
I didn't like them.
This hour of mine is singing. Lover, come back. Lover,
what's the answer? Were the Schubert boys what someone else once called a famous politician, a sphinx without a riddle? Or is there one single fact to which we might dare ascribe all the outrageous things that Lee and J.J. and Sam perpetrated? Perhaps. One day, the lyricist Howard Dietz was having an argument with one of the Schubert brothers. It was about money, naturally. And at one point, Schubert pointed to a list and asked Dietz what he thought of it. When Dietz studied it, he saw that the list consisted of the names of rival showmen, Ziegfeld, Charles Dillingham, and all the rest of them. "What do those names have in common?" asked Schubert. And when Dietz said he didn't know, Schubert said triumphantly, "They all died broke," as if to say, "I'm different." Poverty, as we have already noted, once it arrives on a man's doorstep, is an awful long time going.
We're in the money, we're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along. We're in the money, the skies are sunny. Old man depression, you are through, you've done us wrong. We never see a headline about a breadline today. And when we see the landlord, we can look that guy right in the eye. We're in the money. Come on, my honey. Let's spend it, send it, lend it, rolling along.
The story of the Schuberts in the American Sherman series was presented by Michael Craig. The writer was Benny Green, and research was by Bill Sullivan. The producer was David Raven Allen. And now for the next few minutes, Benny Green will bridge the gap between the Schuberts and next week's subjects in The American Sherman.
And so they finally pass from the scene the most notorious brotherhood in show business history. A team of brothers so horrific that at family gatherings, when the servants wanted to work out how many people to lay dinner for, they used to count the heads and divide by two. There never will be another team like the Schubert brothers again, because God broke the mould while he was making them. What came after was much more civilised, much more sophisticated, and in the case of next week's partnership, much more caring about the finished product. Cy Feuer and Ernie Martin came into the musical production business because they liked the medium. They had a genuine desire to produce quality shows. And they had this funny idea that people who perpetrate musicals have a responsibility to the public too, which was something which would have given the Schubert brothers triple apoplexy had they lived long enough to hear about it. Feuer and Martin represent, if you like, the modern theatre. They're post-war. When you think of old stopgaps like Blossom Time and The Student Prince in the same breath as the shows that these two new partners did, you can see there is such a thing as the march of the generations, and that Feuer and Martin had moved things on quite a bit since the hero stood there watching the oscillations of the heroine's Adam's apple. But the beginnings, so far from being daring, were arch-conservative, because the first success that Feuer and Martin enjoyed was to do with one of the most ancient and, incidentally, most British of all Victorian knockabout farces, as we'll hear next week. There was no holding the two of them after that. They rattled off hit show after hit show, and I suppose it could be said, and already has been by a great many knowledgeable people, that they actually presided over the greatest American musical ever written. I know that kind of claim is contentious, and I doubt if Feuer and Martin themselves would make it on their own behalf. But it is arguable that that's what they did. And one of the men involved in this achievement as director was George F. Kaufman, who knew as much about musicals as W.S. Gilbert did, and was also one of the great purveyors of gloom and pessimism, as recalled by the master songwriter Arthur Schwartz.
Kaufman, who was always conservative and always underplayed the possibility of success, was speaking with Feuer as the run-through finished, which was an excited experience for both of them and for the audience that they had, the few people. And Feuer said to Kaufman, "George, you know, I don't understand. People say when you go to Philadelphia, there's always trouble in Philadelphia. Now, why should a show like this, which we've just seen, why should it have trouble in Philadelphia? I ask you." Kaufman said, "Well, there's one thing, Cy, that you don't know about Philadelphia. The first Tuesday of every month, and that's the day we're going to travel, the Pennsylvania Railroad shuts off all passenger traffic and all freight traffic from New York to Philadelphia. And on that day, all they take to Philadelphia is trouble. So when you get there, it'll be there.
Arthur Schwartz is one of several distinguished witnesses who will be charting the triumphal course of Fuhrer and Martin next week. Ray Bolger will describe how he was first recruited for the show that started it all off. Gwen Verdon will tell how she became Gwen Verdon when she starred in Can Can, and how she wasn't Gwen Verdon at all until she did. We'll hear about the best way to treat a recalcitrant composer when you're producing his show, in this case the boyfriend, and you'd rather he wasn't about. Robert Morse will describe his feelings on being starred in How to Succeed in Show Business Without Really Trying. And Sammy Kahn, author of A Fuhrer and Martin Flop, will talk about the art of how to be trying in business without really succeeding. We'll get the benefit of vocal recitals from Julie Andrews and Sid Caesar, plus the testimonies of Cy Fuhrer and Ernie Martin themselves, and above all, the music. And that, after all, is what these two partners were after in the first place, the music. Always the music.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can't bet that he's doing it for some doll. When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane. When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal, call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money that the guy's only doing it for some dough. When you see a Joe saving half of his dough, you can bet they'll be minking it for some dough. When a bum buys wine like a bum can't afford, it's a cinch that the bum is under the thumb of some little broad. When you meet a mug lately out of the jug, and he's still lifting platinum Baldirol, call it hell, call it heaven, it's a probable 12 to 7 that the guy's only doing it for some doll. When you see a sport and his cash has run short, you can bet that he's banking it with some doll. When a guy wears tails with the front gleaming white, who the hell do you think he's tickling pink on Saturday night? When a lazy slob takes a good steady job and he smells from Vitalis and Barbasol, call it dumb, call it clever, but you can give odds forever.